This is Not the Average Real Estate Podcast by Not Your Average Real Estate Investor. Dipna Boholt used real estate investing strategies to completely replace the income from her accountancy practice with passive income in just 18 months and has since taught thousands of others to do the same. Welcome to the I Love Real Estate Podcast.
Welcome back to the I Love Real Estate Podcast, part three of our special series, Conquer the Chaos Virtual Replays. Now, for those who have been listening along, well done. We're at part three, and this is where actually attending one of these events live would be a lot better than actually listening to it, because in the first part here, Dipna talks about fast tracking, and she gives you a formula blueprint, things that you should be thinking about if you want to fast track your own investment experiences. And then she gets into some complicated content, which is around structuring, exactly how to structure and how to protect your assets, which is highly valuable in environments like this where a lot of people are struggling financially and are losing their assets because they're poorly structured. Now, in this session, Dipna does a lot of whiteboard stuff, so through the audio process, you may not be able to follow along. So if you want to attend one of these sessions live, there may be an opportunity, depending on when you're listening to this, to actually attend a live event. Go to iloverealestate.tv and see if the virtual Conquer the Chaos Live is still available for you to participate. It's free, of course. It may have been retired. We've had in excess of 15,000 people now book to attend this event. So massively popular and valuable. So let's dive into part three, where Dipna covers how to fast track your investments, things to look out for, plus exactly how to structure your investments so you can secure yourself. You know, making $1 million isn't that hard. Keeping it is even more important once you know how. So I'll throw you over to our coach and our mentor, Dipna, where she'll cover you these key ingredients right now.
Now, I want to talk about fast tracking. To fast track success, you need to follow a proven formula. This morning, I was talking about the fact that it took me 6 months to get myself to a market ready position. And that included all of the trying this and trial and error and you know, seeing what worked and analyzing things. I mean, you know, in my previous career, I've done a lot of analysis. I'd done reports that boards of directors would make $200 and $300 million decisions on. And so I come from a very technical, very analytical background. Consequently, when it came to me and me achieving success, I needed to have some foundation behind it. It wasn't going to be a hit and hope, and it wasn't going to be something that anyone else was doing, because there was nobody that I knew, nobody in the media, nobody in the bookstore who had done what I had done, what I was going, wanted to do. Nobody had concentrated on income replacement in property. And when I started to do that, I remember one of my friends came out and he's a professional, and he said, "What do you want to do that for? That property makes you money. You're going to have to pay tax on it." I'm going, "Yeah, and isn't that great? You know, if you're not paying tax, you're not making any money." And it was a real turnaround there when I started to focus on passive income properties. And there's some telltale signs and characteristics that you need to follow in order to be able to do it properly. So over the years, I've taught thousands of people how to replace their income, and people have gone on and done amazing things. But I've refined a formula now that I believe is everything you need to have and to put into place. Now, there's a lot of detail that goes behind this particular model, but I think you're going to like it. And I'm going to start with the first part of it. Now, the first part of it is the foundation blueprint. This is where you need to have your foundations right for your investment portfolio. You need to have the ownership structure right. You need to have the risk profile right. You need to have the strategic plan in place. So foundational blueprint is very important to set something up, because there is no successful building, relationship, empire, company, or even country is possible without solid foundations. So don't be jumping onto realestate.com in your lunch break. "Oh, look, I can buy this, I can buy that." No, That is the last place you actually go to. You've got to formulate your plan first. Now, in your plan, you've got to have cash flow. And cash flow is what gives you lifestyle. Cash flow gives you choice as to what you do with your time. Cash flow gives you freedom. Cash flow buys back your time. You can't manufacture time, and time is our most valuable asset. So we need to buy back that time with positive cash flow so that we don't have to expend time trading our time for money. But you also need growth. Now, growth is what gives you the ability to be able to continue to invest, and it gives your empire longevity, because without growth, you will stagnate. So we start combining them. And if we say, if we've got the foundations right and we've got growth, we might make wealth, but we're not going to be able to give up work anytime soon. We're not going to be buying back that time. If you just have the foundations right and you have cash flow, sure, you'll get some lifestyle, but then you're going to run out of money, which means you can't keep creating more cash flow. You have to go back to work in order to create the savings in order to be able to then go on and buy the next property. If you just have the bottom two, you'll have balance, but you won't have the foundations right, which means someone can come along and take everything away from you. So that's no good either, which is why you need all three. And all three is what gives you that money for life, creating an income stream that you can live on comfortably for the rest of your life, whether you are 20 or whether you are 65 or older. You know, you got to start focusing on this. I've had many, many students that have, you know, in most people's words, retired. Not that they're really retiring, they're doing property full time. And they're under 20, or they're under 30. It's not under 20, they're under 30. They're in their 20s, I mean. They're under 40, they're under 50, they're under 60. You know, it doesn't matter what age you're starting at. It's about how quickly you can get to that destination. Now, there are 9 accelerators that make up each one of these three fundamentals. And here they are. Now, I don't have time to go through every single one of them. I've picked one to go through in a small amount of detail with you out of each one of the fundamentals. But all of them, it's non-negotiable. You have to have these things in place. If you want to build a portfolio that has longevity, that replaces your income and is solid, that no one can take away from you. So the one that I've chosen to do first is the protect your empire. This is the one where we're going to go through some of the fundamentals that you need to have in place about ownership. All right. Now, as we go through these, I've selected some questions to ask you just to get you on the right page as to how you're faring on each one of these topics. So the first one I want to talk about is protecting your empire. Now, I've divided it up into red, amber, or green. Red means no or got no idea. Amber means I got some of it, but not everything. And green means, yep, got it all sorted. So here's my three questions. And I want you to answer red, amber, or green on your notepads. So the first thing is, do you own your investment properties in your own name? Red, amber, or green? If you don't have any investment properties, then you're already red. Do you own your home? Do you have your home protected through structure and or friendly debt? If you don't understand that question, you're red. Do you have your assets and your liabilities isolated and quarantined from each other and you? Red, amber, or green? All right, so just put that aside for the moment because we're going to come back to those questions. I want to talk about why those questions are so important. So we'll go to Australia. Now, when we talk about Australia, Australia is the second most litigated country in the world. In fact, New South Wales is the third most litigated state in the world. And the main areas of litigation come from business ownership, property ownership, and personal actions involving motor vehicles. Defamation in there as well. So let's talk about each one of those. I'm going to talk about business ownership first. Now, if you're going to go out and set up a coffee shop's probably not a real good example, but we'll use that for now. A coffee shop. You'd go to your accountant and say, what structure should I set it up in? Now, some accountants are going to say, put it in your own name as a sole trader. That's that first one there, sole trader. What that means is you're doing everything in your own name. What that also means is if anything happens in the business, you lose everything in your own name. Everything is up for grabs to the risk of the business. Not a good place to be. Some accountants will say, oh, look, pop it into a partnership. That's what you need to do. Husband and wife, we can split the income between you. It's great for tax. Might be okay for tax. But the thing is that in a partnership, you know, if one of you goes, you both go. And you are joint and severally liable for the actions of the other party. So let's say it's not a husband and wife scenario. Let's say it's you and I go into business together. You do something wrong, I would be joint and severally liable for your actions. Consequently, you know, there's a lot of risk in partnerships. Not the way to go. Companies, let's talk about a company. Now, in a company, it is a separate legal entity. It does give you some level of asset protection. However, a company is very difficult to deal with. The only way you can get money out of a company is to either pay wages or dividends. Now, if you do either of those things, there's tax implications to the recipient. Companies are expensive to set up and they're expensive to get rid of, to shut down. They have dividend franking credit schedules. They're just a pain in the neck. From an accounting perspective, they're a pain in the neck. But looking above all of that, let's not talk about, you know, the accounting issues that go with it. Companies, if you buy an appreciating asset in a company name, you effectively pay double the amount of capital gains tax as anybody else. So what you're effectively doing is you're saying, pick me, I want to pay double capital gains tax. And I'm sure that's not why you set up the company in the first place. And then there's trusts. And there's probably 300 different types of trusts in Australia. I'm going to go through three of them with you this morning. Now, the first story that I want to tell you, because I want to tell you a few stories around business, is around underinsurance. Now, this chart actually shows just how many businesses and individuals are underinsured. I had a chap who was in a sheet metal fabricator when I was back in my accountancy practice days, and he had a fire in his warehouse. Now, it did a bit of damage, no big deal. The fire was at night, nobody got hurt. Did about $80,000 worth of damage. The insurance assessor came out to do the assessment on the property and he said, look, you're actually underinsured. You're insured for 300, but you should have been insured for 500,000. Now that means you're 2/5 underinsured. So of your $80,000 claim, we're only going to pay 3/5. Now, that wasn't the end of the story because he had to go and borrow the money off his line of credit. He then, the landlord sued him for 2/5 of damage to his building. The next door neighbor's landlord sued him for 2/5 of damage to his building. The next door neighbor's tenant sued him for 2/5 of damage to his building, to his stock. All in all, that came up to about $120,000. Now, had that fire burnt down half the street, this guy would have been bankrupted. So we talk about being insured and all of these things. That's fantastic. But insurance doesn't cover everything, as you'll learn as I go through this session with you. So yes, you've got to have insurance, but if you're going to have with your insurance, make sure and write this down as a note to yourself. Make sure that your insurances are to at least replacement value. Otherwise, you can be deemed to be underinsured and that can cause a lot of heartache and financial stress and could even cause bankruptcy in some cases. I've seen that happen many times. The next thing I want to talk about is an earth-moving business on the North Shore in Sydney. Okay, it was in the newspapers a few years ago. And this couple, they owned their home in their own name. They owned the business in a partnership, the husband and wife. They owned the land where they ran the business from in their own names. And they owned all the trucks and docks and excavators in their own names as well. So everything's in joint names. Then one day they're happy digging away and they dug up the main fiber optic cable that connected Sydney to Canberra. Now you may not care if Canberra got cut off, but Canberra cared. So $20 million lawsuit, this couple went bankrupt, lost everything, okay? What they should have done is this. The home, put it in the wife's name. There are other ways to protect that property. The land where they ran the business from, put that in a separate legal entity. The business in a separate legal entity. The trucks and drops and excavators in a separate legal entity. So the business rents the land. The business hires the equipment. The business digs up the fiber optic cable. How much do they lose? They lose a $250 registered business name. They still got, they can stop trading as Bob's Bobcat today and start trading as Billy's Bobcat tomorrow. Now, this is how the top end of town works. You've got to start taking heed of this with your own homes, your investment properties, and certainly any of your businesses as well. You must make sure that you are protecting and isolating out your assets. So the most areas of litigation, the next one I was talking about was property ownership. Now, that's not the actual photo, but it demonstrates what I'm going to talk about. It was a young couple, two young couples went out to buy their first investment properties, one in Victoria, one in Queensland. And they both went to their accountant. They said, good guys, you know, your savings, you're buying renovators, fantastic. You can fix them up. Make sure you put them in your own name so we can claim the negative gearing. Fantastic. Both couples buy the properties. Now, the one, they get the building inspection report on both properties. The one in Victoria had a rickety balcony. It was considered to be unsafe, didn't meet code and needed urgent attention. The one in Queensland, the back step that went up to the, was a Queenslander, back step that went up to the kitchen, top step was too high, illegal height. You think, well, God, if that's the only thing wrong with the old girl, you know, we'll buy it. So both couples buy the property. Both couples get tenants in the property. They don't get around to fixing the problem straight away. Both couples put tenants in. Both tenants have an accident. Both tenants sue. Both tenants win. Both couples go bankrupt. Why? Why didn't the insurance cover them? Because in both cases, they knew about the problem. They couldn't evidence that they had taken any action to rectify the problem. Consequently, they were deemed to be criminally negligent, and insurance doesn't cover you in the case of criminal negligence. Let me tell you another story. I have been recognized as a leading expert in asset protection for over 10 years. I actually started speaking to on stage to accountants to teach them how to teach their clients about asset protection. Now, a lot of people come to me after the event and there's nothing I can do for them. This guy came to me and he told me his story. He'd lost his wife to cancer many years earlier. And he wanted to give something back to the Cancer Foundation, who had helped him and his wife through the whole ordeal. He was reasonably wealthy. He owned a number of properties. And he decided, rather than make a donation, he bought a piece of land in the hinterland that overlooked the ocean. And he was building this beautiful long home as a respite center for people who going through chemo could live there and they can eat organic food and get through their chemo and all the rest of it, particularly country people. And anyway, he was going to name it after his wife. About three quarters of the way through building this property, one of the young builders took his girlfriend out onto the building site on a weekend, on a Saturday, to show her the property. She took her three-year-old with her. Now, a child has no place on a building site. Ran around and did what kids do, and she fell down a three-meter drop onto a concrete slab. The child is injured. She's going to need ongoing medical attention for the rest of her life. The child and the mother sue the guy sitting in front of me. Now, he went to every barrister in the state and every barrister gave him the same advice. Mate, you're going to have to settle out of court. You know, sell up whatever properties you need to. We'll cut a deal with the woman. We'll do a full and final payment. Because if you go to court, you're going to lose. Your insurance doesn't cover you and you'll probably end up going bankrupt. You won't be able to, you know, see over the top of the legal fees. So that's what he did. He sold up about three quarters of his properties, gave it all to the woman, gave her all the money, did a full and final settlement. The property never got to the Cancer Foundation. He never got to name it after his wife. Everybody loses in this story. Now, why didn't the insurance cover him? Because his insurance, had the builder been injured, he would have been fine. But because his insurance didn't cover uninvited guests, it didn't cover that child. Now, you can have a burglar break into your house, slip on a kid's toy, break their back, sue you for everything in your home, sue you for everything, and they'll take your home. They'll take everything that you own in your name. This actually happened on the Gold Coast. This happened to, these guys aren't, they are students of mine now. They weren't at the time. They went out to dinner and they had a dog, a Rottweiler, that they kept in their home. And a burglar broke into the house. The dog attacked the burglar and bit off his index finger. The burglar fainted at the sight of his own blood. So the guy comes home from having dinner out and the dog's got the burglar bailed up in the hallway growling at him. He's going in and out of consciousness. They call the police, call the ambulance, take him away. Don't think anything more about it. Then about 6 or 8 weeks later, he gets served with some papers. He's being sued by the burglar. Damages, punitive damages, pain and suffering, medical expenses, and loss of future income because he's unable to work in his chosen profession. He's a burglar. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Anyway, again, he goes to the barristers and they all said the same thing, mate, just cut a deal. The cheapest way out of this is to cut a deal. If we go to court, your insurance isn't going to cover you. You're going to lose. Here am I. You're going to lose and you will have a legal bill that you won't be able to jump over. So don't be doing that. Just, here am I. There it is. Got it. So basically he ended up paying the burglar $50,000. Can you believe that? 50 grand. There it is. 50 grand he paid the burglar. It would have been cheaper just to let him come and take whatever jewelry he was after. So write that down. Your public liability insurance needs to cover uninvited guests. Okay. Now get it in writing and actually spell out, if this were to happen, am I covered? If this were to happen, am I covered? Don't just say, am I covered for uninvited? Oh yeah, you're uncovered. Oh no, that's not what we meant by that. Spell it out and get it in writing. Let's talk about defamation. Sydney has just become the defamation capital of the world. Great job, Sydney. They took over from London. Now, I'll tell you a few stories here. This affects everybody. There was a dentist who he did some work on a patient. The patient didn't particularly like what was done, so he complained about him on social media. He sued the patient and won hundreds of thousands of dollars in defamation. There was a teacher, had some disparaging statements made about her by her students. She sued the parents of the students and won millions of dollars in defamation. And that case is still going on. An ex-wife made some disparaging statements about her ex-husband. Well, who doesn't, for God's sake? You know, and he sued her for tens of thousands of dollars in defamation and won. The list goes on and on. This affects everybody. Personal actions involving motor vehicles. If you drink drive, if you forget to register your car or insure your car, you drive somebody else's car, they've forgotten to register or insure. You know, if you forget to renew your license, you have too many speeding fines you haven't told your insurance company about. You drive with bald tires. You drive with tires that are older than 5 years. You have an accident and hurt somebody, your insurance doesn't cover you. And they can sue you for everything that you own in your own name. So, what's the solution? We've got to separate you away from your assets and your assets away from each other and your assets away from your liabilities. Prevention is better than cure. Now, I don't want you running off and just transferring asset into other structures and whatever, because it'll cost you stamp duty and capital gains tax. There are ways that you can protect existing assets, but there's a lot of false information out there as well, and I'll cover that off in a little bit. So what have we got? We've got a sole trader, very dangerous. That means you do it in your own name. You've got a partnership, even worse, because you're joint and severally liable for the actions of the party, the other party. Companies, good, but you pay double capital gains tax. Trusts, there's about 300 different types of trusts in Australia. Now, I'm going to talk about three of them with you this morning. And superannuation funds are a type of trust. So I'm just going to bring across my whiteboard here. So I'll just bring it across over there. We can see that. Oh, push that over there. Come down a little bit. All right.
And did you want to stop sharing your screen?
So oh, we I can do that. I can do you. That. Actually, I'm going to have to go over here and get some pens. I don't know why I haven't got my pens in front of me. Got my box of pens. All right. So you can see my whiteboard there without my chair. Can we do that?
We can do, yes.
I might just bring it up a little bit. There we go. All right. Well, the first type of trust that I'm going to talk to you about is called a discretionary trust. And it looks like this. Now, in a discretionary trust, as the name suggests, it has discretionary powers. And a trust is basically just a book of rules. That's all it is. It's a book of rules that that govern how the assets are to be dealt with. The manager of the trust is called the trustee. Now, as a trustee, you can have a company where you can be a director or directors of the corporate trustee, or you can be an individual or individuals. My pens aren't working very well today. So either or can be trustees of the trust. Now they look after the asset of the trust for and on behalf of the ultimate owners of the trust, who are called, goodness me, the beneficiaries. I'm not having any luck here at all. Let me try this one. I think I need a delivery from Officeworks. Okay, the beneficiaries. There we go. Can you read that? Now, in a normal trust in Australia, most trusts in Australia are actually family trusts. So in my example here, I've got mum and dad who are the primary beneficiaries. Now, in a family trust, there are three generations all around who are included in the trust. Now, you might go, well, that's all very well, but I don't like my sister-in-law, so she's not going to get anything. That's okay. Now, I want you to write these words down. The beneficiaries have no present legal entitlement. The beneficiaries have no present legal entitlement, which means the sister-in-law here has no entitlement to the asset of the trust. In fact, anyone in this group could be sued and they can't get the asset of the trust. Whether that's you as individuals, now you don't need to be a married couple, you do not need to have children. You can have a single person with no kids. Provided someone somewhere around the world in that three generational circle, which is kids, grandkids, great grandkids, if you've got any, parents, grandparents, great grandparents, if they're alive, sisters, aunts, great aunts, cousins, uncles, nephews, everybody else in between, could, at the discretion of your trustee, receive any income or capital at any point in time. So you can have that. Now, you can also sue the trustee. And you can't get the asset of the trust either because the trustee takes over the liability of the trust, but not the asset of the trust. So the only way that this property can actually ever be attacked is if there's a direct attack on the house itself. So let's say that happens. Let's say it's a $500,000 house with a $300,000 mortgage on it, and they win $1 million lawsuit. How much do they get? Well, here's what happens. First of all, the house will be sold up. The bank always gets their money first, okay? So the house will be sold up. There's $200,000 worth of equity there. So that gets sold up, which means there's $800,000 left to get. Is that the end of the story? No, it's not. Because what can happen now is they can go up and sue the trustee. Because there was an attack on the house, they take over the liability of the house, but not of the asset, but not the ownership. Now, if you're sitting out here as personal trustees of your trust and you own asset in your own name, it's as good as useless to you. Do not ever, ever, ever have personal trustees of a trust that owns an asset directly because they can go up and attack the assets of the directors. The personal trustees. The directors of the corporate trustees' assets are going to be protected provided two things happen. And you write these down. One, that you are not trading, that you are not fraudulent in your trustee company. Two, that you don't trade insolvently. Now, that means don't have a bank account, don't lodge tax returns, don't trade, don't have any employees, no cars, no anything. Nothing happens in this company. Everything happens in the trust. It sits there as the legal entity behind the trust, but it doesn't do anything, okay? That way, there's no way to what we call pierce the corporate veil and go up and attack the assets of the directors. There's no further. That's where the lawsuits end. Now, there's a few important positions here. The first one is called the settlor. The settlor is the one who sets up the trust for you, typically someone in your accounting or legal firm. But there's specialists in the area that you need to be dealing with. Now, there's three things you need to know about the settlor and you must get right. Write these down. One, they must not now or ever in the future be a beneficiary of the trust. Now, the reason that is important is if they're a beneficiary of the trust, the whole thing is invalid and they can attack the assets of the trust. While you write that down, I'm going to tell you a story. I had a lady come to me at boot camp and she said, I think I've stuffed up. I said, what have you done? She said, well, I bought a property in a trust, like you said. And it's, he said, when I was setting it up, my daughter was dating a lawyer. So he set it up for me. And I said, look, it should be all right. Check it for the Bamford case and a few other things. Yeah, I've done all that. She said, they're getting married next month. Doesn't that now make him one of the beneficiaries of the trust and the whole thing invalid? I'm going, yeah, it does. So, well, what can I do? So, well, there's only two things you can do. One, you can set up a new trust and sell all the assets into the new trust. It's going to cost you stamp duty and capital gains tax. Very expensive. She said, okay, well, I can't afford that. What else can I do? I said, break them up and don't let them get married. She took the first option. So the second thing you need to remember about the settle all, so write this down, they must not witness any of the signatories to the trust. Okay, they must not witness any of the signatories to the trust because that will also invalidate the trust. And the third thing goes back to ancient England. Now, we get our laws from England. Back in the 12th century, the knights of the land, they if they went off to war and got killed, the king would resume their land holdings back to the crown and the family was left penniless. If they didn't go to war, they were tried for treason, killed, and the king would take the land. So either way, they didn't end up with their land. The family didn't. So what they did was they came up with this thing called no beneficial ownership. So the family collectively owned the land, but nobody individually owned the land, which meant the land then stayed in the family. Now, that's been changed over generations back from 12th century to us, and we got changed when we got out here. We don't settle land holdings into the trust. We have this thing called $10 or $20, which is the settlement funds. And the settlement funds is what you need to remember. So write this down. The settlement funds must be a gift or a donation. They cannot be invoiced for or exchanged for goods and services. There was a case in Queensland about, it was in the 70s, where a farmer went bankrupt and he owned a very expensive sheep farm. It was worth about, I don't know, $1.5 million back then. That was a lot of money. And he went bankrupt. And the trustee in bankruptcy tried to attack the assets of the trust. They subpoenaed everything they could just to, you know, to try and break the trust. Now, one of the things that they subpoenaed was the original invoice that the accountant used when he set up the trust. And on the invoice, it had so much to set up the trust and $20 for the settlement funds. That one line invalidated the whole trust. So the trustee in bankruptcy put himself as the director of the corporate trustee, distributed off the bankrupt beneficiary, and the farm was gone. So the three things are, one, they must not now or ever in the future be a beneficiary of the trust. Two, they must not witness any of the signatories to the trust. And three, the settlement funds must be a gift or a donation. They cannot be invoiced for or exchanged for goods and services because all of those things will invalidate the trust if they're not right. Now, the most important position in all of the trust is the appointor. The appointor is the one who has the right to sack or appoint the trustee. So in my example, mum and dad would be named as primary beneficiaries. Word of warning, do not name your children in the deed either. They are automatically included in the family group. Don't put their name written into the deed because then they can be deemed to be a primary beneficiary and the primary beneficiaries have to sign the loan documents. I had a six-month-old being asked to sign loan documents once because they were named in the deed. So they're already included. They don't need their names in there. The appointer, mum and dad would be the primary beneficiaries, or mum or dad. You don't need to have your name on everything, okay? So if you're signing the loan documents and say on this house here, we've got a $300,000 loan, mum and dad are the primary beneficiaries. Mum and dad sign as guarantors on that loan. But that means mum and dad are both liable for a $300,000 loan, not $150 each. So if they then go and get another loan, they have to declare that they've already got a $300,000 loan there that they have to pay. So if we had mum or dad there, either of them, then only one of them would have that liability for serviceability with the bank. That means the other party could go off and get another loan separate. So just having your name on everything is not necessarily the case. Mum and dad or mum or dad would be the directors, the corporate trustee, and mum or dad would be the appointers. Now, when you die, this doesn't. So your appointer is what has to be taken care of in your succession planning. So from in your will, a codicil to the will and then to the will or statement of intent with the will, you have to determine who goes in as appointer when you're pushing up daisies. Or while you're alive, if you want this house to go to Johnny number one, you could put Johnny number one as a co-appointer with you. So when you're dead and buried, all he has to do is put himself up here as the director of the corporate trustee, distribute off to his beneficiaries, no stamp duty, no capital gains tax, no probate, no waiting, and in every state except for New South Wales, no contesting of the will either. So lots of opportunity there for the trust, for a discretionary trust. Now I'll show you a couple of others just to so you know what their names are more than anything. See if I can get some better pens here. Go with this one. All right. So another type of trust is called a unit trust. Can you see that? Yeah. In a unit trust, again, you're going to have a company and you're going to have the, it'll be a unit trust and it'll have assets in there. Now, if you and I own the units to this trust and I own 50% and you own 50% over here, we own 50% of the house effectively. So they're defined ownership. But you need to protect these units. So the only way to protect the units is to put them into a no beneficial ownership environment, which is your discretionary trust. So if you own this in your own name and somebody came along and sued you, they then own the units, which means they own half the house. So you must protect the units. The only way to do that is a no beneficial ownership environment, which is your discretionary and or family trust. Your pages there. Now, the other one that I want to share with you is a hybrid trust, which, as the name suggests, it is a combination of the two. So in a hybrid trust, again, you've got a company up here as a corporate trustee. You've got units like you do in a unit trust, and then you've got beneficiaries like you do in a discretionary trust. Okay, so you've got a combination of the two. Now, a lot of these have got all the bells and whistles, and they seem really, really good. Some of them are even called property trusts, but be very, very wary. I like these for businesses. I hate them for property because they are operationally, they are too hard to deal with. Banks don't like lending to hybrid trusts. There's only two banks, in fact, that'll lend to a hybrid trust. So the last thing you want to be doing is setting up assets in hybrid trust and make lending very, very difficult. Because remember, that's our lifeblood. So use these for businesses. Do not use these for ownership of property. And some people try and negatively gear their units in the unit trust, which is very, very dangerous because the tax office has got an alert out on anything going through a hybrid trust because it can't be done. All right, so how would this work? Let's say I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy three properties. What structure should I put it in, do you think? Thumbs up. Should we put it in a discretionary trust? Yes? That sound right? All right. So let's put it into a discretionary trust. Is that what I do? No, it's not. Because, write this down, whatever you group together dies together. Whatever you group together dies together. So don't be doing that. Now, the way you structure it is this way. I'm going to go and buy one property. So here's my one property. I will use one discretionary trust with one corporate trustee on top. That little unit there is going to cost me around $2,000. Now that $2,000 is the cost of doing business. I will show you how you can negotiate to bring down the cost of the purchase to save yourself this $2,000 to have it set up properly. Okay. So one property, one company, one trust. When I go and buy my next one, I'm going to have one company, one trust, and it goes in there. Go and buy another one, one company, one trust, and it goes in there. All right. Now, trusts are pass-through vehicles. They don't pay tax in their own right. They can, but you don't want them to because they'll pay tax at the top marginal tax bracket. So let's throw a few figures on this and I'll show you how it works. Let's say this one here is negatively geared $20,000. This one here is positively geared $10,000 and this one here is zero for tax purposes. Trusts pass down their profit. So this $10,000 would go down to the beneficiaries to pay tax on. But this loss cannot. You can't distribute a loss out of a trust. So that loss has to sit there in that trust to be offset against future profits in the trust down the track. However, if you've got the right words in your trust deed, you can take the profit out of this one distributed up into that one. So that one's now zero for tax purposes. This one's now carried forward loss indefinitely of $10,000. But you've got to have the right words. Give me a thumbs up if you want to know what the words are. You've got to have in your trust deed. Thumbs up. Yep. All right. Write these words down. Able to distribute to associated entities. Your trust deeds need to be able to distribute to associated entities. That has to be written into your trust deeds, because trust deeds are the Bible in here. Whatever is in the deed, that is how the deed is run. And this has been proven over and over again, precedents of law over the last couple hundred years that we've been in this country, and another couple of centuries in England. So, precedents of law, we can able to distribute between associated entities. That means we've got great flexibility for tax purposes. Let's say we're going to go and set up another trust up here now, and this is going to be our business trust. So I'll squeeze it in there. And in our business trust, our coffee shop, will say we make $100,000 profit. Okay. So the first thing we're going to do is, that's after wages and salaries and everything else, we take our $10,000 off. It leaves us $90,000 there. Put that $10,000 down here. Take up that carried forward loss. Gives us zero for tax purposes. Now we've got $90,000 to do something with out of this trust. So let's assume that all of our beneficiaries earn more than $37,000. Now, the reason I say that is because from zero to $18,200, we pay no tax, individual tax. $18,200 to $37,000, we pay 19 cents in the dollar. $37,000 to $90,000, we pay 32.5 cents in the dollar, and goes up from there. So what entity pays a higher rate of, a lower rate of tax than 32.5 cents? Put in the chat rooms for me. What entity pays a lower rate of tax than 32.5 cents in the dollar? Put in the chat room so I can see. Super funds, companies is the main answer. Okay, thank you. Let's take a company, okay? So if we distributed this $90,000, should we give it to this one, this one, this one, this one, or should we even it across all four? Give it to me in the chat rooms. Which one should we be doing? Even it across all four or give it to one of them? Come on, give it to me. One of them, even it, even it, even it across all four, even it, even it, even it. No, 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 no. I tricked you. I really tried to trick you then too. What we do is we set up another company. And the reason for that is I call this one here a bucket company. We set up a new company because, remember, I said to you, do not trade in your corporate trustees. Do not lodge tax returns. Do not have a bank account. Do not do anything in your corporate trustees. As soon as you do, what that means is that they're going to be trading, which means that you could be trading insolvently, which means that they could pierce the corporate veil and go up to the director's assets. That's why we do not trade in the corporate trustee. So we set up a new company over here, a company, and we call that a bucket company. The right color. So we're going to take our $90,000 and we're going to distribute it up to our bucket company, $90,000. It pays tax at 30 cents in the dollar, which is 27,000. It might pay less than that, but let's say 27,000, which gives us $63,000 tax paid money. Now, we can get that out by either lending it out, paying a salary out, but then that's going to be no good because we already said they're earning more than 37,000. Or we can give a dividend, but then with a dividend, they're still going to pay individual tax rates, which means you're back to the tax problem. So what we're going to do is we're going to lend that money down to another structure down here and put another property in there. So the money goes down as a loan. Loan agreement down here. Proper loan agreement. Now this, for the deposit plus the cost to go and buy that property. The rest of the money comes in from a bank. Okay, the 80% will say from the bank, 20% is coming down here as a loan agreement. So let's say this is the one with the rickety balcony, the fire hydrant, the burglar, the whatever, and it's the one that is that we have a problem with. It's the one that gets sued. How much money do you reckon they get? Tell me in the chat room. Tell me in the chat room how much money you think they get. If this is the property that's being sued, You're right. It's zero. It's zero, zero. Because the bank gets its money first. They don't even get the 22, the 63, I mean, because that money, you're the next secured creditor. So what you've actually done up here is you've created your own little merchant bank. Because it's a deposit bank to go off and give put deposits into other assets. So over time, you're going to have money flows going backwards and forwards amongst the trust. You're going to have money coming down from the business entity. You're going to have money going up there to the bucket company. Money coming down here to more trust to buy more properties down here like this. Loan agreements going backwards and forwards like that. Is that not the sexiest thing you've seen all morning? Okay. People, you're going to be thinking, oh my God, this is going to cost a fortune. All right. One company, one trust together, $2,000. Ongoing, it won't. You don't need all of that to start with. You need one company, one trust per property, that's it. Ongoing, it won't cost you any more in your tax returns either, certainly not with my accountants, because to do a property schedule in your own name takes no more time than it does to do a property schedule in the trust name. And our accountants work on doing this in from a time basis. So everything's built on time spent. So ongoing, it's not going to cost any more from an accounting perspective. The only additional cost that you're going to have is the registration of your companies. Now that'll cost you around $300 a year. Okay, so I know that looks complicated and, you know, I had to whiz through it, but we go through this in a great deal of detail and you don't end up with all of this on day one either. It takes time to get there.
So I hope you enjoyed part 3 of Conquer the Chaos. Now, again, that was a session where if you were watching it live, you would get a lot out of it because Dipnit does a lot of stuff on the whiteboard there and went through specific strategies. So again, if you want to go to iloverealestate.tv and if Conquer the Chaos is available to you, you want to attend a live session, like I said before at the start of this podcast, it is free to attend and humongously valuable just for that session alone. You'll get a lot out of it, and then, you know, add all the other bits and pieces to that as well. So I hope you enjoyed part 3 of Conquer the Chaos replay. We look forward to sharing with you part 4, where we'll go further down the line of structures and asset protection and how to actually, what sort of structure you should be using for your own investing. Plus, as well, with part 4, we'll be covering Dipnit's famous property blueprint, where she goes through exactly the key things you should be doing to focusing on building an effective property portfolio and all the accelerators that go into building a successful portfolio and where people need the most help. So I hope you enjoyed part 3. Look out for part 4. It's coming to you very, very shortly.